Testing, 1, 2, 3, 4. This is side two of tape number one, interview with Evelyn Bobby Trout. And it's now 5:20, and we're going to get out of her way so she can get herself some dinner here pretty soon.
Don't worry about me. I've had enough at lunch.
It was in the we were just talking about it was in the first air derby. In 1929, August 29.
Yes.
And all sorts of things were happening to the women between San Bernardino and
Yuma,
because she ran out of fuel unexpectedly and had to make a forced landing field and ended up cracking up her Golden Eagle on its back. And Amelia nosed over her Vega in Yuma. And I think it was just after Yuma that we had a bet.
Margot Crossan was killed right at the Gila Bend. Right out of Yuma.
Barbara Crossan.
No. Marvel.
Marvel.
Marvel Crossan.
M-A-R-V-E-L. C-R-O.
S-S-E-N, I think it is.
Crossan. And how did that happen?
No one's quite sure. No one quite sure what happened. That I recall, it was something went wrong with the plane, or she became... can't remember whether she became ill and they saw where maybe she had thrown up or something, or something happened to the plane, but I think it was that something went wrong with the plane.
Did it crash and burn?
It didn't. I don't believe it burned, but it certainly did crash and killed her immediately.
Well, when's the last time you what time after that do you ever remember hearing or knowing anything about Amelia?
After that, well, I have a let's see. About after that, Amelia. Then we had the 90, then we had our 99s and letters from Amelia and stuff, and then various times that she would come out, you know, and we would meet as a group, you know.
You'd see her at the airport, or they were having a banquet somewhere.
Or somebody's house or so, or wherever we were having the meeting. And that was, oh, a few times. Then of course, I'd get letters from her every now and then. And of course, she'd congratulate me on my flights. And then she stopped in to see the governor in, I think, Arizona one day, and she came up. He was laughing at this picture in here, which showed the prince or the king and someone else in this carriage in Spain. Down below it said, Bobby Trout and Amelia, or Bobby Trout and Elmer Smith are refueling the airplane and so forth. So anyway, he was laughing, and she sent a little note along with it and sent it back to me, which is rather interesting, and I have it over there in my scrapbook. So just little things like that would have happened. And
she, when you set a record, now she would send you a little note congratulating you?
A few times, once or twice anyway. And then about the 99, or keep up the good work, or something. There are a few things in there that I have.
Now she moved out here in 1935.
Bought a house over, I think, in Toluca Lake.
That's right, Valley Spring Lake.
Mm-hmm. My folks, my mother and aunt lived over there several years when the freeway took her house. We built for them.
Did you ever see her then, or did you ever meet her husband, G.P.?
No, I never met him.
Did you ever see her in 35 or 36 or 37 before she made the round the world flight, or after the Hawaii flight?
It could have been that I think not too long before she made that flight that she was out here, and we were together. A group of us were together. But I can't remember any more than I thought, well, she surely doesn't have much to say. She's very quiet.
Did you ever attend one of her lectures?
No, never did.
Did you didn't really know her socially then?
No.
Only through common interest in aviation?
Common interest in our aviation and things like that.
Did you talk to anyone or anything about, or have any opinions about her abilities as a pilot?
Well, as a pilot, she was considered considered fine and dandy. I mean, you know, a good pilot.
Yeah, by her peers, by yourself, by Louise Staden.
Yes, by everyone who knew her seemed to think she was a good pilot.
She wasn't known as a great pilot, or she wasn't known as a weak pilot.
No.
Everybody thought she was a very competent.
A good pilot.
No strong feelings one way or the other. Just
no, in a roundabout way. The only bit of talk against me is flying was when she flew. Someone told me that they saw her fly this autogyro. And that is sure. What they said wasn't very complimentary. But after all, she might not have known the ship very well either. You know, after all, you can't sometimes just get in a brand new ship that's entirely different and be an expert. You know,
and they weren't exactly perfected, were they?
That's right.
They were rather.
So now that's the only time that I think I ever heard any detrimental talk about.
Did you ever know her pilot, Gorsky?
Gorsky, no.
Did I say
you mean her navigator?
Mechanic?
No.
Did you
by name. Now, I may have known him real well around. Where was he from? Do you know?
He was New York.
From New York? No. I didn't know too many New Yorkers.
She also later on had a mechanic in 1936 and 37. What's his name, Marie? Houston.
Bo McNeely.
Yeah, Bo McNeely. He was from Mississippi.
No, I don't know. I doubt that I ever...
Did you ever see her Lockheed 10? See it?
No. Not to my recollection.
Do you remember when she flew across the North Atlantic alone, 1932? Do you remember that at all?
I remember just the paper...
Do you remember any thoughts you had about it at the time? Maybe like how lucky she is or something like that, to get a chance like that?
Well, yes, I suppose that I did. Of course,
Do you remember when she flew from Hawaii to Oakland in 1935?
I was up on all of those things at the time.
Let me drop Amelia then and go back to your flying career. You'd set in 1929, you'd entered the Derby, and in 1930 you were working for the Ullman outfit, and you set some endurance records. And then
No. He came to me in 1929. It was after the Derby that we started in on our refueling endurance flight. See.
Go ahead and tell me about those.
And that was about Thanksgiving time.
Oh, I see.
Well, right here it says, Tomboy stays in air 17 hours to avoid washing dishes.
Yeah, that was my second solo endurance flight. And that was the time that Carl Spatz was up in the Army, making the first refueling flight for the Army. And he sent a letter over there to the woman who's making the endurance flight, congratulations and so forth.
Very nice.
Very nice. Then we made our first refueling endurance flight about Thanksgiving. I believe it was Thanksgiving Day that we came down. And the reason we came down was all of a sudden we had this old flying boxcar, you know, they called it. And I was taking on gas. Eleanor was here by my side in this open cockpit flying. And I had the hose in the tube here, you know, the pipe that going into the gas tank. And we were taking on gas full force when all of a sudden black smoke started pouring out of this refueling ship. And boy, they started turning and going down at the same time. And away went the hose and gas. And we were frightened to death. We circled around, you know, watching them go down for fear that they were going to hit a high tension line trying to get back to the airport. But fortunately, they didn't. They got back okay, but we were worried to death.
But now you didn't have a refueling plane now.
No, so there's no refueling plane, so we had to come down that night out of gas. We weren't completely out, but we knew we would be shortly. So
did you land in Metropolitan?
So we landed in Metropolitan.
And that set the record for women endurance at that time.
It was the only one that women had ever tried.
What kind of airplane was it?
Ours was a Sunbeam, and the manufacturer was out at Metropolitan Airport, and we promoted that to make the refueling flight in order to give him advertising. And
remember who he was?
Green was his name, who manufactured that plane.
And
Waldo Waterman was head of the, in charge of the airport, and I'll never forget this. He used to wear this black mustache, you know, heavy black mustache. He was sweet, and he just would do anything for us, you know, that he could. But I'll tell you, we had to go up and come down about five times before we finally stayed until the refueling ship let us down. And he would always come out to kiss us goodbye and kiss us hello, and I thought, oh my God, if I have to stand that mustache another time, I'm going to quit this flight.
Okay.
But Waldo was sweet. He certainly was nice.
What was the next flying that you did after that?
Let's see, a refueling endurance flight of that. Then, and now we're in depression, of course, so
yes,
things, you know, if flyers are flying free, just keep up their time. So I would keep up my license, but I didn't do any commercial flying until, let's see, and R.O. Bone had bad, so he'd moved his factory back to Ohio, and of course I'd gone over on my back in that beautiful little plane, which just made us all sick, you know. But I couldn't help it because I ran out of gas and I did the best I could at trying to mush it in, you know. So anyway, then depression's bad. Oh, on the first solo endurance flights, we'd get letters from all around the world wanting to buy the planes, but he couldn't sell them because he had only an experimental license plane. So then he started in with a test pilot from Douglas, I believe it was, testing it to try to get it perfected so that we could get a regular license on it. And those early ones went to flat spins. Well, anyway, he finally came out with this, the Golden Eagle Chief for the race. And if we'd made that, why, it would have helped. But of course, we're now in depression, and instead of getting orders, why, things are going downhill. So finally, and then of course, turning over my back, why, and things of the world being bad, he moved his plant back to Ohio. Toledo, Ohio, I think it was. Toledo, Ohio. Anyway, I don't think it was long after that that he sold out or else went bankrupt. And I understand he went back into the seed business that he'd been in and made a lot of money in St. Louis, or St. Louis, Kansas City. When it
comes under the heading, I know there's money in aviation, I put it there.
Yes, I put it there. In those days, you know, there was a lot put there, and boy, it certainly...
Then what did you do after that?
So in 1931 was when Edna Mae Cooper came to me, right after she'd gotten her solo license. She came to me and said, Bobby, will you go on refueling flight for women with me if I get the plane? I have a man who wants to get some advertising. He was going in the investment business in Beverly Hills. He wanted some advertising, of course, publicity rather. So I said, surely, I'll go with you. So he bought a Challenger Robin from Moseley over at the Grand Central Air Terminal. And it is a Robin that had been sitting around for quite a while. And our promoter would not have the engine opened up and looked at because he was told it was okay. So up we went with the plane as was, except for the Tim brothers who put the opening in the back and put the gas tank in for us and the little propeller driven pump, you know, pumped the gas from the tank up into the upper wings, which fed the gas by gravity down to our engine. And everything was done beautifully. They did a wonderful job. The Tim boys were great.
How do you spell that?
T-I-M-M. Wally Tim and Otto Tim. And Otto is dead, I understand now, but Wally's still down around the desert. anyway, we had this all set and all ready to go up out at Mines Field now, which is now the LA International Airport. Then it did the, on my second Solar Endurance flight, it went up from that place, but there was a little tin hangar, that's the only thing that was out there. By now, 2 years later, they did have a little stucco building and a few other hangars with planes in them. But anyway, we went up, we took off, and our promoter had hired the old Pigeon again to be our refueling ship. Well, we hadn't practiced or anything else. We just took off in our plane with enough gas to take care of us for a while, because Louis B. Mayer and actresses and actors were out there and flowers and everything to see us go off on this big flight. So, well, anyway, up we went, and it was a rather cloudy, dismal day, and we circled around the airport waiting for the Pigeon, you know, to get the engine started to come up and refuel us. Well, two or three fellows had all hooked their arms together, and the last one take a hold of that huge prop and pull on it, and they all run, you know, and pull on the prop, and they did that, and they fooled around with the carburetor, and they did this and did that to it, and here we're watching them from up above, and they can't get that doggone propeller to start. Well, anyway, it finally got dark, and no refueling ship, and we didn't have enough gas to keep us up many hours. So now, you know what our wonderful promoter wanted to do? He went to McLean, who was the man with the aviation department and all, who was giving us gas for this flight. He went to him and said, I want you to take 5-gallon cans up there and give to those girls in the dark, you know, and keep them up there tonight. He said, well, I won't tell you what he said, because it was plenty. Because he told me later, he said, boy, he said, I wasn't about to come up there in the dark and try to feed gas to you kids in the dark and kill you. Why, he said, anyway, he called him about everything he could think of too, and nothing, what have you, you know. But he wanted us to step so badly. But I didn't stay that long. When it got dark and all, and I knew the refueling ship wasn't coming up, why, I said, Edna May, we're going in. So I took it in, and we sat down. And he was burned. Oh, all the difference in the world in Jack Sherrill, all of our 5 attempts out at Metropolitan, I mean, come down and take off and come down and take off. And he'd come, oh, you poor kids, you know. And this one just gave us H-E-double-L because we had come down in the dark, you know, instead of staying up and running out of gas or waiting to have 5-gallon cans. So anyway, about 4 or 5 days later, he did get another ship, a larger Robin, and they fixed it up with the tank and all so that it could refuel us, and so then we went up again, and we stayed, the whole trip was about 123 hours, but the morning of the last day we were up, I had been asleep, and I had just taken over controls, and we were waiting for the refueling ship to come up, you know, the sun had just come up. And all of a sudden, the engine started to go, and then, and the old revs had died down, and then it had cough again, and then the revs had died down, and then the oil began spewing all over our windshield and back up into our refueling pipe, which is right by the stick down here in our cockpit. And that kept on and kept getting worse. It started with a crack in number one piston, and when we got down later that afternoon, when we couldn't stay up, we had a hole in that number one piston the size of a silver dollar. That is the reason we had to come down. But I'll tell you some interesting things that happened, if you like. The first night when we went up to stay, I took off and flew a while, and then we were 4 hours at a time approximately is what we would work. Well, after I let Eleanor get at the controls, naturally it's dark, and she just had her private pilot's license and had never flown in the dark. And so at first she'd have us in a spin, she'd have us in a dive, and then she'd have us in a stall, and I'd say, or I'd say, end of May, pull back on the stick. And then she'd go too far, go forward on the stick. Then she'd go down too far. And then she'd come back. Oh, I did that all night long the first night when she was at the controls. She finally got so that she could keep it on the horizon. All right. Until the last day when it's all filled with oil, well, you know, nature called and I went into the back of the ship.
How did you handle that?
Well, they fixed a little place with a little hole there and we sat on it. So anyway.
Out in the atmosphere.
Yes. Yeah. High enough out in the atmosphere. Supposed to go just become atmosphere. Anyway. So here I am back there about 3 or so in the afternoon. And she got up to see, and I had started about 6 o'clock in the morning. I sat there about 3:30 or 4 in the afternoon, and right in there. When she went up, and she, now we're so full, the windshield's so loaded with oil, you can't see a horizon. See.
Could you add oil to the engine?
Oh yes, I even drained it and added oil. I had a steel deal that would unscrew the. A little valve that would let the oil go out, and then I had this pipe that was up there from the engine on the inside where I'd pour oil in. So I'd even drain out some old oil every now and then and put in brand new oil, and then I'd add to the new oil too. So those Tim boys had really had us all fixed up very nicely. I think we could have stayed up the month that we expected to stay up okay if it hadn't been for our engine going bad. But anyway, they didn't have instructions to go into the engine, see. So anyway, that last day, now here I'm sitting in the back of the ship. She's up in front and we're going. First we're in a dive, and then we're in a stall. Now we're in a dive, then we're in a stall. And I'm just back there absolutely in hysterics, laughing at the crazy situation. Well, anyway, I finally got back up in the front seat and stayed there until we were about out of gas and the sun was setting, or had set, anyway, and I landed. That was the end of our flight.
How long was that flight now?
Almost 123 hours, 122 hours and some minutes, I can't remember. It was almost a week.
Was that, of course, was a whole new record.
Oh, yeah, surely. See, I had been on the first one, now I'm on the second, so I'm on the first two refueling flights for
all
women.
All right, now just for a little break, I want to ask you a couple, three questions.
Mm-hmm.
One, in all the women pilots that you talked to, you know, Amelia Earhart became kind of the world's most famous woman pilot, really.
Well, yes, of course, you see, when she went down and all of this, wondering just what happened and mystery about it and all and everything, and she had done a lot of things, you know. After all, she married Putnam and had all the money behind her for publicity and all, you know. So, and that was what he wanted and what he got because she was able to do it.
Okay, so in all that time, and all time since, before mm-hmm. and after the fact, had you ever heard anything or talked to anyone or in any way believed that Amelia was on any sort of a thing except just a trip around the world?
No, I've never been able to, no one ever brought anything like that out at all.
Did you ever hear anything after the flight that made you think that anything happened besides that she just ran out of fuel? And
No, the only thing, of course, you know, this picture, you know, where Russell was in this picture, you know, that indicated something like that when she played the part of Amelia, and it brought that deal into it. That was the thing, I think, that got everybody suspicious about the thing. thing.
But you, your personal knowledge and being a prominent woman flyer, having known her personally and known many other women who knew her, nothing ever came to your attention that made you suspicious in any way?
None whatsoever.
What do you think happened out there that day as far as the end result?
Of Amelia? Well, it could have been most anything. As I said, as I remembered hearing the news that had come over the radio, that either there was a terrible storm coming up or they were in it. I thought they were in it. But that they were running out of gas and they were in a very dire predicament. And then the next thing we knew, nobody heard anything of them yet in the ship or anything. So she was lost. And that was that's all. That's all.
Did you know Jacqueline Cochran?
She was coming in to doing her flying about the time that I was, had done quite a bit and was more or less going winding down because of depression and all that sort of thing, and so I had met her, but I really didn't. That was all, as far as knowing her, no. Now, down at the desert, I had a talk with her one day down there, and that was all. But she was always, usually, she had someone who was taking notes, and she was doing a lot of, sending letters.
Did you visit
here,
her at the ranch that day, or you just saw her?
No, I saw her at the ranch that day.
How did that come about?
Well, I don't remember exactly what happened. I know that I saw her out the. I know I saw her at the ranch, and just exactly what happened, I don't know. But all I remember was that, by golly, she had this secretary so busy and all that I thought, well, what the dickens? Why spend any time around here, So. I left, and that was it.
What was the year you were planning to fly from Honolulu to Los Angeles?
But I don't remember what year that was. Did it say on?
That's what I'm looking for.
But Lockheed were building a plane for me to do that. But then we went out trying to get contracts, on the advertising things and all. That time, so many flights had been made that we couldn't come up with enough contracts then to be worthwhile. So it was given up. We had envelopes printed and everything else, to sell their cachets and so forth.
Isn't that a lovely couch, Marie?
Yeah, just like mine.
We have one exactly like
it. Oh, do you really? Oh, I'll be darned. I saw it and I thought, oh, those colors are pretty. And then, of course, I worked it in with the other colors.
She has done quite a few.
Oh, I'm sure she has. Now, why don't you ask some questions, Marie, right now? Because
may I tell you something that I think would be of interest to you right now? Before we went on this second refueling endurance flight, Guy Ball, who was in charge of the Irving Parachute Company, and Edna May, and I believe our manager, and all of us were together, and we were walking somewhere, and Guy Ball said, that he'd made up a little chute to drop our tin cans and stuff in, And I thought, oh my golly, the minute I heard a little chute, and we had this little opening in the back of the fuselage that Edna May would stick her head up in and get a hold of the bag of stuff that had come down and a rope then that would lead the gas hose down. And when I heard that throwing him out with a little chute, all I could think of was danger, my golly, the chute getting caught on the tail surfaces. And so I said, oh my land, no. Well, he has the one to save those cans and this and that, and so any messages we could send down and all. So I said, now, right off the bat, I said, Edna May, if you throw that out, you've got to have it wound up together, and you've really got to throw that hard, or it's going to get caught in our tail surface, sure as God made little apples. Oh, she'd do it. So anyway, now, we're up the first day, and we had made our last contact for the day. And it was just the sun had just set, and it was just a little light, that's all. But anyway, she I dove down over the, right down over it, and I'd say it must have been within 20 feet of the landing strip right over there at, you know, the Metropolitan Field. And she was supposed to have thrown this out, which I suppose she did as hard as she could, but it wasn't hard enough. So do you know that darn chute caught in our tail surfaces? And boy, it opened up wide. And boy, it was just like, well, you know, it was just like putting a great big brake on that. And boy, I'm telling you, my wings wobbled, and I was sitting on eggs galore there, trying to keep that plane straight up with that darn brake on the back of us. And I just barely cleared the wires at the end of the airport. And still, you know, with my heart in my mouth and everything else, trying to keep the thing level. Well, of course, down the field, the fellows saw immediately our predicament. They looked around and fished around and finally found, I don't know where they found it, a long pole, and tied a long knife onto the end of this pole. And I gradually made a real wide circle, you know, gradually coming back around that field to the left. And fortunately, as we went, this chute is beginning to circle a little bit, see, which is beginning to wind up.